Hello and welcome. This is an audio recording of an IFG live event. I'm delighted to welcome today Rory Stewart to this conversation with the Institute for Government. I'm Bronwyn Maddox, its director. Rory, a very warm welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
As you'll all know listening, Rory Stewart was standing as an independent candidate for Mayor of London and was one of the first public figures to call for a nationwide lockdown. He then ended his campaign when coronavirus forced the mayoral elections to be postponed to next year. From 2010 to 2019, he was Conservative MP for Penrith and the Border. In May 2019, he was appointed Secretary of State for International Development. His previous ministerial posts included a stint at the Ministry of Justice, Minister of State for Africa in both the FCO, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, and the Department for International Development. He's a former diplomat and author of several books recounting his long-distance walks in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the Scottish borders. All of that is highly relevant to what we're going to discuss today. Rory, let's plunge straight in with coronavirus, which is inescapable, and indeed the Chancellor who's spoken today. What did you think of what he said?
First thing, I think they are struggling with a very, very unprecedented, difficult situation. And one of the things you notice looking at it as an outsider is, firstly, the temptation to bring in measures which you were probably tempted to bring in anyway without coronavirus. So stamp duty, for example, is something which I think is certainly every Conservative leadership candidate seemed to be talking about cutting stamp duty, and it's now been done. And that's been wrapped into a coronavirus budget, but was probably something that was driven by other reasons. And then you have the coronavirus specific stuff, of which I'm particularly skeptical about the restaurant measures. It seems to me that the reason that people don't go to restaurants is because they're worried about their health rather than that they're worried that the meal is too expensive.
I think that's an excellent point. And I was wondering whether you felt that there was a trade-off at this point between health and the economy. Early on, you might say that there wasn't, in a sense, and people were just very afraid and that there was no way of detaching those two questions from each other. And you were one of the people arguing for an early lockdown. But the point that the Chancellor and indeed the Prime Minister tried to make at the moment is, look, we've got to take steps to do something about the economy. Do you feel that they're wrong to try to focus on that separate from the health questions?
I think they're absolutely right to think about how to get the economy going. I think it's extraordinary to lose 18 years of growth in 2 months, and we are going to end up with a very, very unrecognisable economy, not least in terms of the amount of debt the government's about to bring on, the likely rise in taxation and the rise in government spending. I believe strongly that we should have acted much earlier to lock the country down, but equally I think it makes sense to open up. And that's why we need to look much more carefully and thoughtfully at the countries which have navigated this much more successfully than Britain. And the obvious candidates, of course, are South Korea and Germany when it comes to testing. But even countries like Japan, when it came to a much more straightforward strategic approach in terms of where they allowed people to go and where not.
If we think back a long couple of months ago, you were for shutting schools early. What do you think should be done now? Has the government got it right?
I think schools need to reopen now. And the evidence on child transmission suggests that there is less risk than there might have been. Remember, many of the measures we were taking 3 months ago, even 4 months ago, I started calling for these things, I guess, in the middle of February. So maybe even now, 5 months ago now. We're at a time when we knew very little about this disease. There's still a great deal that we don't know, but we have a much clearer concept of where the risks really lie and which sections of the population are most at risk. So I think there is a decent argument for schools up to a certain age. I think universities is a bit more difficult. And then at the other extreme, I think we have a very clear idea now that nightclubs are not a good idea.
You were critical, as you've described in a way, of the government's handling of this crisis going into the lockdown. Do you feel they're doing better, though, on the path out? As you said, we know more.
I'm still not clear what exactly their theory or strategy is and what their analysis is, either in terms of the virus or in terms of the economy. I think they need to be much, much more explicit. And I would be much more reassured if I saw full internal government analysis published of what they think the lessons are from South Korea or Germany or Japan and how much of that they think is applicable to Britain. a lot of this seems to be done on the basis of not very precise argumentation. You'd expect much crisper scientific data and much crisper numbers, instead of which it still feels to me ambiguous. And the key thing in any crisis is very, very clear, simple and consistent communication.
Do you think the devolved nations have done better? I mean, this is one of the very interesting things about the way the UK has handled it. The devolved nations very closely coordinated at the beginning, and then in quite marked ways, beginning to go their own way. And we may not have seen the end of that. I'm thinking particularly of schools and the treatment of exams next year, for example.
So one of the things that seems to have been most impressive about the way in which Nicola Sturgeon in Scotland responded was her willingness to take centre stage and be very consistent and rapid and thoughtful in her communication. And she seems both to have won public confidence by doing that and achieved a decent impact on the virus itself. And I think it's a lesson in political leadership. I'm not a fan of Nicola Sturgeon. I don't like nationalist politics, but I do think that in terms of emergency response, having one clear, consistent advocate for a policy is very important. And I think the endless rotating cast of ministers in England was less helpful.
You campaigned against Scottish independence, and you've just spoken again against it. Your views have always been absolutely clear on that. Do you think, though, it's now become more likely because of the coronavirus crisis and Nicola Sturgeon's handling of that?
I think, sadly, Scottish independence is terrifyingly more likely. The current opinion polls suggest an overwhelming majority for the SNP in the next elections coming to Parliament, and they will then trigger a request for an independence referendum, which will be very, very difficult for the central government to refuse. And on current figures, if that referendum is held, Scots will vote for
not legally impossible.
No, they could simply refuse. But I think as a Scot, and I think my view would be shared by almost all Scottish members of the Conservative Party, even though we are passionate unionists, we find it very difficult to believe that it would be possible if the SNP campaigned for a referendum, won an overwhelming majority in the Scottish Parliament, for the UK government to refuse to allow a referendum, even though I would be heartbroken by the risks of that referendum and the result.
How would you advise Boris Johnson and his government to handle this? They're grappling with one huge crisis at the moment. They're trying to get back to their other agenda, which I want to talk about in a moment. And then, as you say, this is potentially coming down the line at them rather fast.
Well, I and Prime Minister Johnson, and indeed I think all the other leadership candidates in the leadership election last year, made very strong commitments to do far more to strengthen the United Kingdom. We signed up to principles where we were going to create a new Department of State, which was going to be a department for the Union, with a very senior Secretary of State, where we would be putting far more regional development funds branded as United Kingdom support into the region so that people in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland could really feel the benefits of being part of the United Kingdom. We were envisaging much, much more both regular trips of senior ministers and the Prime Minister into the devolved regions, but also challenging every government department to do more and demonstrate the value of the United Kingdom. That has not happened, I'm afraid, in the almost a year that Boris Johnson has been Prime Minister. And that isn't because of the coronavirus. That's something that's come along much more recently in his tenure. Those departments have not been created. Those steps have not been taken. And unless the government really prioritizes it, they are in serious danger of losing this referendum. And I'm not quite sure why they're doing so little. I fear sometimes that some people in London maybe simply are not as focused on this issue as necessarily those of us who have Scottish family might be, or it might be that they believe somehow, having won the Brexit referendum and the election, they have some magic formula which is going to allow them to pull this off against the odds. But I'm very, very worried.
Do you think there should be more mayors around the country? I'm fascinated by what you have learned in your time campaigning to be mayor of London, which obviously you're not doing anymore. I wonder whether you think that being mayor is one of the best jobs in UK politics, or one of the worst, in the sense that you often don't get that much power, you don't actually, or money from the central government in Westminster. But people still think you're responsible for all kinds of things like crime and traffic jams.
No, I think it's the reverse. I think it's a fantastic job. I think you have enormous power. I think the odd thing is that some mayors, and this is one of the things that has frustrated me with the Mayor of London, go around emphasizing their powerlessness all the time. And indeed, very convincingly so, so that often the public will simply say, oh, well, the mayor doesn't really have much power over that. So people will acknowledge that the mayor is the police and crime commissioner for London, and therefore is responsible for the Metropolitan Police in its actions in London, but not blame the mayor for anything that's happening with crime in the capital. So I think there's something very odd. I think that the mayor of London has more power than the mayor of New York, has a budget of £18 billion a year, which is more than the GDP of almost 100 countries, and yet behaves as though they are powerless. And I think we need to have mayors who believe in the potential of those roles and don't approach them, as I fear mayors of London often have, as ceremonial roles. They are instead, you know, as Andy Burnham, I think, has amply demonstrated in Manchester, roles with huge potential.
That's a really interesting point, and something that the IFG does quite a bit of work on. The Johnson government's answer to regional inequalities is to talk, as we know, about levelling up and now build, build, build. Do you think that that's the right kind of answer? Do you think much more of that power and money needs to be devolved to people locally to do those things?
Must be devolved locally. I mean, the only way that you can really have a genuine renaissance of the regions is if power is located in those regions and the decisions are made within those regions. It's very dangerous, both in terms of the quality of the projects. I think you're going to end up with worse projects if they're run by civil servants in London, but also local people will not take the same pride and ownership of those projects if they're perceived to be things that have been imposed on them from London. So absolutely, if you're going to lead a great revival of Northern England, you have to devolve budgets. And I'm horrified, for example, that the government has announced that they're now putting government people on the board of Transport for London. I mean, one of the central powers of the mayor was that he appointed the entire board of Transport for London. What the government is actually doing is stripping back the powers of mayors.
Let's turn, given the past that you had before you became an MP, I really want to turn to foreign policy at this point and to what you might call an example of devolution, devolved government unwinding, and that's Hong Kong at the moment. You were born there, and I was wondering what you felt 23 years ago when the handover took place. Were you optimistic then?
I think I was worried then. I was there at the handover. I was in the stadium as the flags came down and the flags went up and the Black Watch Piper played, and it was a worrying time. And then really for the next 20 years, things went much more easily than one would have thought. I mean, it became understandably a much more Chinese in culture and in tone, and felt culturally less influenced by Britain and British administration, but it remained an extraordinary place. My sister taught at university in Hong Kong and still teaches there. My brother-in-law lives in Hong Kong, so I remain very close to it. But I think what has happened over the last few months is really disturbing and is a real reminder there, and with the Uyghur and with the Sino-Indian confrontation, that China is not fulfilling people's dreams of 30 years ago, that it was somehow going to become a normal partner in a liberal global
system.
Going
back just 10 years, George Osborne as Chancellor called for a golden era of Sino-British relations. Did he misread China? Was having the wrong dreams?
Well, I think he probably quite rightly acknowledged Chinese power, quite rightly acknowledged that China was going to be one of the great global powers, and that therefore it was very difficult in the context to imagine a prosperous future for Britain that did not involve close and intimate relations with China. But I think he may have underestimated the geostrategic developments. And I think there was reasons for all of us to do that. I mean, after all, most of the establishment in Britain and the United States and Europe went a very, very long way to encourage investment in China, to allow the development of a global trading system, which gave huge economic weight to China and made our economies very dependent on China. So it would have been very uncomfortable for people having done that to acknowledge that in doing so, they were potentially fueling the economy of a country that could be a strategic adversary.
I quite take that point, and I think you put it very well about the calculations then, and it's not that long ago. But what should we do now? What should we do about Chinese students in universities? What should we do about Huawei and the 5G network? We've got a series of difficult decisions now, don't we?
So I think Chinese students in universities, we should continue to support and encourage. I think they're have been nearly 20% of the income of British universities, and I think educating people is a very good thing to do. It doesn't always have all the grand results that idealists hope. It doesn't always make people pro-British. I mean, famously, we educated a lot of independence leaders whose experience at universities in Britain actually turned them off Britain and alienated them from Britain. But I think generally it is a good thing to continue to educate people. Huawei is more difficult. I think the idea that we can entirely separate off our classified and super strategic elements of the network from the general network, which is what the National Security Council and others have been trying to argue for 3-4 years now, is difficult to sustain. And it's particularly difficult to sustain when most of our major allies are turning away from Huawei.
You've written a lot about Afghanistan and spent a great deal of time there. And I was wondering what your perspective on it was now. There's this enormous British commitment of forces to Afghanistan, to Helmand in particular, which didn't sort of reach deep into understatement, go to plan. Do you think there should be an inquiry on that? And would you say something as simple? Would you go with something as simple as that we lost that battle?
Yeah, I mean, that was a very, very sad event, because the British government and the military were in denial for years. It was, to my mind, clear by 2002 that it would be very, very foolish to try to do a counterinsurgency surge in Afghanistan. And it became even more clear. Yeah, 1 year in, I felt the great strength of Afghanistan was that they had not, that they had, in inverted commas, by 2003, been distracted by Iraq. In other words, all the resources and money had gone to Iraq. It was good because it prevented the coalition from trying to put huge resources on the ground or trying to somehow fight a counterinsurgency campaign against the Taliban. And of course, very sadly, by 2005, that policy was being reversed, and we ended up with nearly 150,000 foreign troops at a time in Afghanistan and over 100,000 international contractors and $100 billion a year of expenditure. And we were boasting about...
I mean, we built a city with Camp Bastion. Really.
Yes, and much more than that. I mean, obviously the figures I'm giving are US coalition figures, not UK-only figures, but we were insisting month in, month out that we were winning. This is now Britain. That this was the decisive time, that this 6 months had turned it around, that these small towns and villages in Helmand, Nadi Ali, Goreshk, which held 3% of the population of Afghanistan, were somehow critical to the future of the country. And of course, almost all those places where we shed blood and we fought to take were inevitably lost after our departure. And this was so blindingly obvious, and yet Labour governments, Conservative governments, brigadier after brigadier, general after general, and indeed an enormous number of journalists persisted in trying to sell for I guess, almost 7 years of fantasy that somehow this was a sensible thing to be doing.
Would a public inquiry be useful? That was one into Iraq, after all.
Yes, I think it would be a very, very useful, incredibly useful, and should be done, because we must try to understand how on earth we developed that type of optimism bias, how we got ourselves into a situation where we kept thinking if we just had a few more troops, it would be fine, ended up having to bring in 5,000 members of the US Marine Corps into Helmand without making a great deal of difference, despite the fact that it was blindingly obvious that we did not control the borders, that the Afghan government was not sufficiently legitimate in the eyes of the people there, that corruption was a big problem, that the Afghan police were never going to be able to take the strain. All these things were really, really obvious before we deployed to Helmand. I did a session with the British government in 2005 before the deployment, planning for the deployment in the summer of 2005, where I and many, many others kept saying, don't go to Helmand. And the answer seemed to be, well, that decision's already made. What should we do? It reminded me very much of somebody saying, we're going to drive a car off a cliff. Should we wear a seatbelt? And my saying, don't drive the car off the cliff. And they were saying, well, that decision's already made. Should we wear a seatbelt? And I would say, well, by all means, wear a seatbelt. And they'd say, we've consulted with policy expert Rory Stewart, and he recommends we wear a seatbelt.
No, look, you've described beautifully and rather bitterly the we can do it sort of attitude that I remember very well from then. Let's jump quickly. I'm conscious of actually the large number of questions we've got, some of which we're covering, but to Brexit. And you were musing in a Spectator article earlier this year about how Brexit will be remembered when your son reaches your age. I was wondering what you were thinking. Is it going to seem like a huge change that Britain has made, or just a blip giving way to all kinds of fudges and essentially the same kind of relationship?
That is so difficult to know, because of course the Brexiteers embarked on this absolutely desperate to avoid a fudge, and my career and that of Theresa May and anybody else who tried to argue for a moderate soft Brexit has been blown up on that altar. They, you know, if you were to speak to Marc François, the whole point of the Boris Johnson government, the whole point of the Dominic Cummings government is to avoid a soft Brexit or a fudge. They want to have basically no more relationship with Europe than they have with Thailand. That's what their vision of global Britain is. And so I think it will be difficult for Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings, even if they wished, to return to a soft Brexit model, partly because of the promises they made and the type of MPs they've brought in recently.
So you think we're heading for a no-trade deal end of the year?
Yes, I do. But then, you know, these things are very difficult to evaluate. I mean, I have been from the beginning very doubtful about the idea that it's possible for Britain to get the kind of have your cake and eat it deal that everybody talks about. I was an advocate for trying to go for a softer Brexit, you know, a Switzerland model or a Turkey customs union model, something that existed out there that you could take. But these things are apparently felt as such a huge constraint on sovereignty that the whole government system is arranged to prevent us ending up there. In which case, I can't quite understand how we're going to get there. And a lot is being betted on the idea that somehow Europe at the last moment always gives us something better than we would hope.
Well, sometimes it does, but that's a hard thing to count on. I quite agree. Talking of the whole government system, one of the recent changes the government's made is to say it's bringing together the FCO, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, with the Department for International Development. And I think you have not been a fan of this, but do you think it could be good for the Foreign Office, which has been losing clout in Whitehall and overseas in recent years?
Well, I think the fundamental question is, what are you trying to do? What does the Foreign Office hope that it can do with this money? Because the government is also saying that it's going to retain the International Development Act, which very, very narrowly restricts what you can spend that money on. It's supposed to be spent on poor people, basically. in developing countries and in the poorest countries of the world. So the Foreign Office has often looked with great envy on DFID and its budget. And subconsciously, diplomats have hoped that maybe they could use it for more diplomatic purposes. In fact, they probably resent the fact that their estate, their residences, their embassies are looking tatty, that they have much more restricted travel budget. They have much less flexible money to spend on almost anything, but they're not going to be able to get that money out of the DFID budget. And the second problem is that if you put diplomats who are not people who have managed large projects on the scale of DFID projects, they don't know how to manage a £200 million, 3-year, multi-stakeholder education project in Ethiopia with the World Bank. That's what DFID does. And trying to put diplomats in charge of that is likely to end up just with nonsense, just bureaucratic infighting and not much benefit.
So a waste of time and energy. I'm interested in what you've been describing as well, and just reaching back into your answer about Brexit, about what's happened to centrism in British politics, and indeed what's happening to conservatism. Where do you think the Conservative Party is going?
It's very difficult to tell because it's such a fraught question, this. So there are people like myself and my friend David Gawk who feel very strongly that the traditional liberal, centrist, One Nation Conservative Party is vanishing, and that the new coalition that they formed in the Red Wall with voters who tend to be more socially conservative in their views is a sort of Trumpian coalition. It's a move away from the centre ground. Now, the answer to that from people like Damien Green, who was a member of the One Nation group, is that nevertheless, the government is committed to levelling up and spending money in the regions. I don't think that that's really a answer. So I don't think that levelling up really explains the, doesn't really help you to answer the question of centre against left or right, because many right-wing governments have spent a lot of money. That's not a sign that you are liberal or a party of the centre, just that you want to spend a lot of money on infrastructure projects. I mean, famously, I don't want to overdo this because the government is completely different to this kind of thing. But if you take it to the extreme, of course, governments like Mussolini's government spent a huge amount of money on infrastructure projects and on, inverted commas, levelling up without that making them somehow One Nation centrists. So I think the Conservative Party is becoming more right wing. And I don't think the fact that Boris Johnson wants to spend more money makes it any less right wing. I think that's just a different, that being right wing is an aspect of culture rather than economic policy.
A fascinating answer, which I wonder whether the Chancellor would agree with. But let's go to audience questions, because I've got lots, and they will quickly overlap with the things that I might ask you. And just picking up or following from your last answer, let's start with one from Mark McCurgo from Edinburgh. And he's from something relevantly, I guess, called the Centre for Solutions Focus at Work. And he says, Rory, you were flung out of the Tory party. What's your future? And do you still support the Conservatives? I'm not sure he's offering you particular solutions at work, but he wants to know.
Well, so answer is that I have left the Conservative Party, and I think I'm very unlikely to ever return to the Conservative Party. I think that culturally I see the world in a very different way. That, of course, was partly about the fact that I passionately believe that we needed a compromise over Brexit, and that that wasn't just a compromise because that was a good way of thinking about a practical trade solution for Britain. It was also a way of healing the country and bringing it together. I'm very opposed to aggressive contrarian politics, and I hated the idea of trying to divide the country between Remainers and Brexiteers. I was trying to find a centre ground. So I don't think that there is a place for me in the Conservative Party, and I think many of my former colleagues have breathed a huge sigh of relief that I've left, which is sad for me because it makes me question what I was doing during the last 10 years of my life. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, Ian Duncan Smith or Marc Francois do not really think that I'm a conservative. And they, in fact, I think Ian Duncan Smith has said so repeatedly on record. As far as he's concerned, my departure is good riddance.
So thank you for that. And that doesn't quite answer the one part of Mark's question, which is what you're going to do next. And I've really got that from quite a few people who want to know whether your ambitions might go into another international job, back into politics, or what you've got in mind.
I think I'm going to take a very much a break from British politics, and I'm looking to throw myself into issues that I love and care about. And if that's in Britain, it is issues like prisons. The job that I loved most in British government was being Minister for Prisons, and I think there is a huge amount more that we need to do to make our prisons decent and safe. And I think they're a crying shame. Internationally, I am very, very keen to throw myself into the question of how we work in conflict, how we work in countries that are emerging from catastrophe and war. What would it take to try to provide a better future for people in Congo or South Sudan or Somalia, or even to some extent Syria? And that probably is likely to take me abroad. Now, whether that is working with a big international organization or whether it's setting up my own charity or combining it with teaching, I'm not quite sure. But those are the issues that I'm likely to throw myself into.
Thank you for that. Okay, we've got one from John Lloyd, a contributing editor of the Financial Times, saying, do you believe that the nationalist surge in Scotland can be halted? And if so, how?
I think the only way that you could halt the nationalist surge in Scotland is by demonstrating now, immediately, and over the next 2 years, just how much England cares about Scotland and how much the United Kingdom is going to do for Scotland. At the moment, it looks like an independence referendum is going to be held and Scots will vote for independence, and it breaks my heart. And the only way of stopping it is, of course, convincing Scots that they have a much better, richer future in the United Kingdom than they have as an independent Scotland. That partly involves government policy, United Kingdom government doing things for Scots that really make people understand the benefits of being part of the United Kingdom. And that could be both investment in Scotland, but not just investment in Scottish-only projects, but in projects that bind. So I'm very interested, for example, in projects at the borders between England and Scotland, the ways you can link those regional economies together. I think it's also very, very important, though, to make a cultural argument for the United Kingdom, explaining that we're better together because generally nothing is improved by reducing and cutting off. I would say to friends in Scotland that the danger of what they're doing is that they are, of course, driven, many of them, by anger about Brexit. But the way that they're approaching it, sadly, has some of the same tone of Brexit to it. It's a worldview that suggests that you make your life easier by cutting yourself off from others. And in my experience, nothing gets better by erecting a border. And in the end, that's all that nationalism of any sort is. It's about borders. It's about saying, this is us, and you are other. You are them, and we don't want to be part of you. And I think that is not a good direction to be going in the 21st century. We should be reaching out, not cutting ourselves off.
Well, following that question, or your answer, let's pick up one from Iris Kreber, who's head of agriculture and land within the Department for International Development. And she says, I'm sending this question as a private citizen, but obviously I've got an interest as a UK civil servant to hear the response from our former Secretary of State. And she describes the UK as torn between retreating into splendid isolation and the vision of global Britain leading the world, and wonders what thing you would recommend that the government does in the next 2 years to reconcile what seems like a contradiction.
Well, I think it's going to be incredibly important that anything that we do in international development is very, very thoughtful and very focused. And we do not simply fall back on a lazy idea that there's some clever way of the Foreign Office getting their hands on international development money and somehow spending it to turn us into global Britain. I think we've already got signs that the 0.7% isn't really safe. The government's already announced a $2 billion cut to the amount that DFID is spending this year, which hasn't been picked up very much by people except the development community. And there are some very thoughtful things that a thoughtful government that wanted to improve what we do in international development could be doing. I think there's a very strong argument that we need a much stronger field presence, that we need to develop our country offices, that we need to have more senior DFID staff on the ground, that we need to find ways of giving more freedom to country offices. My dream would be that we would set up an international development foundation in somewhere like Nepal, almost with an independent CEO, and the government would allocate a budget over 3 years and discuss a strategic plan, but then the CEO would be able to get on with it in the way that the chief executives of our national parks, for example, get on with things in Britain. Much, much more arm's length, much more distant from government, because the current system is very, very, very cumbersome, very risk averse, very bureaucratic, and wastes a lot of opportunities.
We could develop that. I mean, for really the rest of the podcast, but I'm not going to do that. Let me pick up one from Beverly Meekings, who says, and she speaks for quite a few people who've written into us, saying, what did you learn from your overnight stays with people in London? Come kip with me, part of your campaign. And has this influenced your thinking?
I think I learned an enormous amount. Just to take two small examples, I stayed with a young man whose family were originally from Ghana, and there were five adults in a two-bedroom flat just off the Wandsworth Road. And the more time that I spent with him, that's going through his daily routines or going out to see him play football with friends, the more I was struck by just how excluded his life was, and how little confidence he had in opportunity in London, and how sad that was, because we celebrate sometimes, for good reasons, a sense of our, you know, that we're good at being a multi-ethnic city. But he did not feel part of a multi-ethnic city. I think his life felt very excluded and very marginalized. And then secondly, to take another example, staying at a homeless shelter in Bromley, I was again very struck by the fact that the council at that stage was claiming they had three homeless people in the borough, and I was staying in a shelter where there were 12 people sleeping in that shelter, just in one place. And many of them had been there for many months. One of them, I think, had been there for a number of years. And when I say a shelter, what I mean is somewhere where you tidy your bed away. We tidied our beds away, I think, at about 6 in the morning, and then didn't put them out again till 10 at night, because it was a church hall used for other activities during the day. That's not a home for anyone. There, and again, I suppose in Stratford, in the underpass, I was struck by how little was being done for the homeless in London, and how easy, actually, it would have been to deal with these issues. And I was very struck by the fact that Manchester managed to halve rough sleeping in a 2-year period when London made little progress.
Well, thank you very much indeed for that. I've got one from Kiffer Roberts on a subject we haven't talked about, which is Russia. And she says, just as an aside, she's met you several times in the past, including in Kabul in 2001 when you were doing your walk through the region. And she's got various questions about whether Russia is undermining Western democracy, including talking about these reports that about whether Russia was paying the Taliban to kill Western forces in Afghanistan. But she wants to know whether you think the UK is in some way beholden to President Putin's government and therefore is not releasing the report into Russian interference in UK democracy, which is supposed to come out from the Intelligence Security Committee.
I don't think that the British government feels beholden to Putin's government. And of course, the Foreign Secretary has been a long proponent of the Magnitsky Act, which he's now brought through. I think that they may have other reasons for not wanting to publish that report, but I don't think it is that they feel beholden to Putin's government. I think one of the things which has encouraged me about this government is that it has been willing to challenge Russia and challenge China.
And finally, because we're going to have to wrap this up, sadly, though, I've got really a flood of questions. One from Owen. I'm going to hazard a guess that his name is Owen Pugh from his email. And he says, what advice do you have for young aspiring politicians? Doesn't say whether he is one.
But he wants young aspiring politicians. Well, I think in the end, politics is about character. It's about.
I'm wondering whether we're going to get a version of Don't Put Your Daughter on the Stage.
Yeah, there's a lot. You're definitely going to get a version of Don't Put Your Daughter on the Stage. I mean, you are asking a pretty traumatized individual. So obviously, I would begin by trying to gently encourage somebody to think whether they really want to be a politician. But if you're going to be a politician, I think the central point is that it must be about moral character and having a sense of what the virtues of a good politician are. And you need to hold on to that in the face of the fact that the system, if you're not careful, is so arranged around loyalty and promotion. Or, to steal a phrase from David Willetts, a Mephistophelian bargain of promotion in exchange for loyalty. And that is the currency of the whips, and that's the currency of government, and it can feel pretty lonely to try to find another way of being a member of parliament. But one has to. One cannot fall into the madness of thinking that all it can come down to is parroting government lines on news shows in the hope that you can get a promotion. There must be something more to it. And I think that must be going back to a much older Renaissance idea of virtue in politics.
But to take a slightly more worldly take on that, is being the head of a committee, for example, I'm thinking of Jeremy Hunt, is that a route to a satisfying career?
Well, I didn't find so. I was chair of the Defence Select Committee, and I was very, very struck by how little attention the government paid to any reports that we produced. Even when we went pretty hard and found out some, I thought, some pretty explosive things about government policy in Afghanistan or Syria. And of course, sadly, as a government minister, I became very aware that our departments paid not a great deal of attention to what was going on in the committees. I think it's a cultural thing. I had a better relationship with the Justice Select Committee as the Prisons Minister than perhaps with other committees, and was challenged more effectively by the Justice Select Committee. But generally speaking, I'm afraid the fact that we have no separation between Parliament and the government is fatal for the committee structure. Committee structures work much better in systems like the United States. But if everybody on the committee is trying to become a minister, they don't have much incentive to really be brutally critical of the government.
Finally, I've got one from Nick Davies, but versions of this from lots of people. I mean, is social media for a modern politician, is it a blessing or a curse?
For me, I think it's something that you can use to advocate for the centre ground. I mean, my leadership campaign was very much based on dodgy selfies and videos and walkarounds. And I used the fact that I've got a quarter of a million followers on Twitter to be able to get out and make arguments that I couldn't make through the conventional media. I would find that, you know, the Times would not report my story on National Citizen Service, or the Telegraph would ignore my stuff on adult social care and instead do a front page on the fact that I'd smoked opium in Iran. And I found that I could then go out on Twitter and get 650,000 people, which is many times the subscription of the Telegraph, watching my statements on adult social care. So it became a route to talk about things that editors might think were unfashionable and uninteresting to the public, and a way of proving that, in fact, the public was much more interested in a much wider variety of things than the editors imagine, and that social media is the route into that.
Well, thank you for that as a closing shot, because I can absolutely testify that we've barely scratched the depth of the questions that we've got. Anyway, people really want to know what you think about pretty well any aspect of government. So, Rory Stewart, thank you very much indeed for joining us, and I look forward to people's comments even more when this goes out.
Well, thank you so much, and very, very best wishes, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you've enjoyed this edition of IFG Live. Please do subscribe to hear more, and if you'd like to know about our upcoming events, please visit instituteforgovernment.org.uk/events.